That brings us to today. Returning once again, all the way from Los Angeles area, is Roulette William Smith. I should say Dr. Roulette William Smith. His topic today is on the biogenesis and development of terrorism. Now, Roulette is a cross-disciplinary scientist with expertise not only in biology but in sociology. And what I really appreciate about him is the ability to blend concepts from both scientific disciplines in a unique and thought-provoking way, as you're about to find out. Oh, goodness. I don't have my notes about his background with me. They're in the other folder. But Roulette has been a professor through Stanford University in Palo Alto, and is also the testing officer for the University of California, California State University. And it's one of the things that he does a lot. He'll tell you more about that. Please welcome Roulette William Smith. Put this on you. Put it there. There. And this can attach to your belt. Congratulations.
Thank you. I think this is probably the fifth time I've spoken to the San Francisco Tesla Society, fifth or sixth. I started out when they were over at the Fort Mason. I can't remember what the topics were, but they probably dealt with slow viruses. But it turns out everything I talk about is actually related in a number of ways. And by way of minor introduction, I took my PhD at Stanford in mathematical modeling back in 1973. The emphasis was on computer models in education, teaching particularly. I taught at the University of California, the Santa Barbara campus, for 5 years, 6 years. And then I went to medical school here in San Francisco at UCSF. And in the second year at the medical school in San Francisco, I heard a lecture by Stan Prusnik, who subsequently got the Nobel Prize. He talked about the slow viruses, and I realized then that the slow viruses are particularly interesting because they always knock out memory and brain. That was what his emphasis was. And I observed that they also knock out memory in the immune system. So I wrote a theoretical paper in 1977 which anticipated AIDS and almost every aspect of AIDS that we now know. In 1979, that paper was published and presented in the Neurochemistry Conference in Jerusalem, and I essentially dealt with three, four, or five issues. I said that slow viruses could be sped up or slowed down. I said that slow viruses are, in fact, parsimonious and, in fact, give us information about evolution, about speciation, about development, about differentiation, about cognition, about immunity, and about death. And I set out then to develop a model, a molecular model of memory, how memory works. So all of the things that I have been talking about have been focused on molecular models of memory. I now am on the faculty of the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology in Palo Alto, and so I'm up here every weekend. But I'm also the testing officer for Cal State University in Dominguez Hills. I do the testing officer. I hold that position for two reasons. One, because of some dreams I have for generalizing test theory to something similar to a medical model, but beyond the medical model. That is, that not only should we test, but we should also arrange for prescriptions and then modifications and improvements, so feed forward and feedback. I also took the testing officer position because the Dominguez Hills, although it's one of the lesser known campuses in the Cal State University system, is one of the campuses that has the greatest needs. It also has a fairly good school of education. And my dream, which led to my going to the medical school, was to see that medicine was taught in the elementary and secondary schools. I believe that if you teach people about disease when they're healthy, then when disease finally occurs, they'll know who to go to and they will not be sold a false bill of goods. My dream is to deal with two groups of people, and this is the overarching area of my research. These are people I call the unknowingly needy, people who need help but don't know that they need help, and the worried well, people who don't need help but worry and constantly go and consume medical services. These are areas that have not been dealt with very well. The things that I will talk about today are actually kind of quite unusual to you, but in fact it still falls within a grand scheme of things. In 1985, my ex-wife said, you know, I really should get out of the house and stop doing research and things. So I looked for a job that it would be fun, and I was not looking for money, but I was looking for a job that would allow me to do something productively in terms of a social service. And I took the job as a coordinator of a mathematics laboratory at the Cherry Chase Elementary School in Sunnyvale, California. The math lab coordinator's responsibility was to help kids who were having difficulty with mathematical problems and help students who were above average, performed above average, but who needed some enrichment. It was during that time that I observed, I think in my notes here, a set of 7 kids who simply didn't have common sense. And you might ask, how do we know that people don't have common sense? Well, one of the nice things about mathematics is that when you have a problem, you not only have a right answer, but you have a circumscribed set of wrong answers. For example, if I say, how much is 1 plus 1? These are kids now 3rd through 6th grade. You would expect them to say 2, or 0, or 11, or minus 1, but you would never expect them to say 39. And in fact, I had an instance of a kid saying 39. So I knew that something was wrong, and I asked myself, what could be said about this. Each of the kids had different strange manifestations of this, what I call aberrant common sense. Some of them, it would be raining cats and dogs outside, they'd have galoshes and a raincoat and umbrella, and they would just walk out in the rain as if this was just a sunny day like today is. So I mentioned this first to the school librarian. The school librarian is a Japanese American. She was educated in America. She's second generation. My ex-wife was third generation. She had lived through the Second World War, had been in the internment camps, but she had also had some familiarity with Japanese education in Japan. And so I said to her, you know, I got these kids, they're really making all kinds of mistakes that I cannot explain why it's happening. And she said, oh, you know, that's really interesting. Those same group of kids, she said, if you presented them with a story in prose, they would have difficulty understanding it, that is reading exercise. And she said that if you gave them a story in pictures, they would create their own imagery, their own story, but it would not be the story that was intended. And I said, well, could you give me an example of this? And she took from a book called the Shikoto Dotoku, which translates into Elementary Morality Education, two lessons that I've carried around with me. There's a whole set of 3 books that are kindergarten, first, second, and third grade. This is a lesson that is early on in this Shikoto Dotoku. It starts out with a rabbit, a bear, and a pig in a foot race. Can everyone see and understand that? Can you see it? I'll give you a few seconds to just look it over. Let me move this over here so. Can you see it there? Now, what the story is about, if you look at it, is about the rabbit, the bear, and the pig. The intended message is that the rabbit is the swiftest of the 3 animals. It gets ahead. It encounters a boulder or some obstacle in the pathway. The other 2 animals finally catch up, and in a way, the 3 animals push the boulder out of the way so that they all cross the finish line at the same time. Now, if you think about it, in American society, we would never teach. We would teach competition. one person wins, another person lose, but we would never teach cooperation in the sense that this cooperation has occurred here. So my first observation about this was not only were these kids having difficulty, because if you asked them to interpret this picture, they would give you a wrong interpretation of it. You could get all kinds of fanciful interpretations, but that's the one that was intended. What I realized at that point is that these kids were not only having problems with common sense as I would recognize common sense, but they're having common sense in general, problems with common sense in general. And moreover, the common sense that we use in our society is very different from the common sense that would be used in Japan. So, in fact, when people sneer at the Japanese and say that they are a group of people who work in one way and not in another way, they are indeed correct, but it's so because of the way they've taught, starting at an early age. And again, I emphasize this is morality education, which we don't even have an equivalent of in our society. The second lesson, which is maybe 10, 20 pages later, I think the other one was on 14 and 15, this is on 26 and 27. The Japanese read right to left. They teach in cartoon-like characters because it's so difficult for the young child to learn kanji and hiragana type characters. So they use cartoons to teach at the early age, and then subsequently they move into the more complex Japanese script. In this lesson, it's extraordinary for several reasons. It shows a fox blocking a rabbit here, saying, in effect, look, you can't cross this footbridge. I have to cross first. The lesson doesn't say this, but this is what I hope you'll see. Secondly, it shows the fox blocking a badger, that is, and the badger knows not to go across. The third panel here, they show a monkey, and they're trying to show that there are other ways of fording the bridge, that the monkey can do this rather cleverly. So the fox goes across on the top, the monkey goes across on the bottom. In the fourth panel, it shows the fox encountering a bear, and is recognizing, well, I've treated the other animals this way, so I must, it thinks, let the bear go across, and then I go across subsequently. But what the bear does instead is it helps the fox across. And this is the extraordinary step that we would not teach in our society. It goes back, and it shows the fox teaching all of the other animals what it's learned from the bear here. So again, I recognize that not only were these kids having some difficulty, but secondly, there is a major shift, a major difference in the way that common sense works in Japan. So I started thinking about the fact that we've talked about common sense, Thomas Paine, others, but we really have no psychological studies on what common sense is. So I started studying common sense throughout the world, Japan, Germany, United States, and other areas. I focused on Germany, Japan, and the United States largely because the common sense we see in Japan is highly homogenous, very homogenous. Everyone gets these textbooks. In fact, not only every student does, every parent does. So we have a top-down system of education that is generalizable to all persons in Japan, and there really isn't any great variation in these lessons. And what you may ask is, well, what happens in Japan when we get to the high school level where there's extreme competition to get into the universities and whatnot? But at least at the elementary school level, this is what the way the education is taught. And I was looking for the original text because there are some other really prescient images that you should see. For example, one of them that always comes to mind is it shows three or four kids in a confab. One of them has brought a priceless vase to school. The vase breaks, and so the kids get around, sit around, and they discuss who should take responsibility for the broken vase. Should it be the individual who brought the vase, or should it be the group, or whomever? It never answers the question, but it forces them to think about the issues. And there are various other examples from this. I chose Germany as the second society to look at the study of common sense because the German society is a little bit more heterogeneous. It has different districts, different, they're not called provinces, but federal districts. And Germans are more rule-driven. So you see that their common sense is emphasized in law more than you would see in Japan. The thing that is also interesting is that I focused on recipes, cooking. What I found is that the Germans would give you a recipe for Schmarrn or Grunersauce or something, but they would never give you all the details about what the one final step, maybe what the temperature might be or what the quantity might be in precise amounts. And I thought that was interesting. And of course, in the United States, it is extremely heterogeneous. We have no centralized education throughout the states. And so I thought this was fascinating. I did this work back in 1985, as I said. I mentioned it to the school principal. And the school principal said to me, why don't you take these observations and present them in a parent-teacher conference to the parents of these kids? After all, they're the ones who are sending the kids to the math lab, and they're the ones who are concerned about the students' performance. They want the students to get better. But what I observed, and again, this is through my eyes, through my lens, these parents were the most negative people I had ever encountered in my life. In fact, I had never thought about negativity, never ever, until that moment I made that observation. So I asked the question, could there be some connection between the negative parentage and the performance of these students, or the lack of good performance, the lack of common sense in some way. And as I thought more and more about it, I was only in the math lab for about a half a year, but I really began to puzzle this issue through. And finally, I wrote a paper, which was presented, I think, in 87 or 88. It's in the announcement. I presented it at the International Congress on Psychology in Sydney, Australia, where I hypothesized that if we look at this chart here, Piaget is normally thought of as the person responsible for the literature on the development of logic. And we have around the two-year-old, we have what we call the terrible twos. So if any of you have been around 2 years old, older, you have your own kids or you've babysat for some of them, you know that the two-year-olds are really one of the major developmental periods of challenge. The parent is always saying, no, don't touch the hot stove. No, don't run in the street. No, don't use this particular language. No, don't use those words. It is a litany of no, 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 no. But it is legitimate no's. The purpose is to teach the child right from wrong, good from bad, hot from cold, up from down, safe from unsafe, and things of that sort. But in the regular developmental cycle, after three and a half years old, there should be a set of more positive experiences. And what we find in these kids is that the children were brought up negatively throughout their life. Now, these are people who were 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old. And I asked the question, could it not be that a disturbance during that period of time, which is not properly shaped later on, might that not lead to some fundamental aberrations in performance? And I introduced the notion of a psychovirus, a communication, a snippet, a negativism, which is transmissible, which causes a distortion in learning in some way. And this is, remember now, before we had the major emphasis on computer viruses and whatnot, but I, in fact, was conceptualizing the first example of a psychological virus that interacts with what goes on in brain and causes a disturbance. And I asked the question, in fact, must all psychoviruses be negative or have negative origin? Could it not be could there not be some positive ones? For example, where did the notion of God come from? Could it possibly be that somewhere back in historic time, long-term historic time, that someone said, oh, God, And that becomes a virus that gets transmitted. And now we have a concept, we have the notion of religion, we have the notion of spirituality, all that's evolved from some snippet of information that's been communicated. So I don't want you to think that all psychoviruses are negative, but I do want you to recognize that that was what led to the genesis of these the things I'm going to talk about today. I also said, well, if we have kids that don't have common sense, could we not have leaders that don't have common sense? So Ronald Reagan was is the president at that time, and I asked the question, if you go back and you look at his history, read biographies of him, you would know that his father was an alcoholic, his mother was very negative, and in fact, if you follow his career, you know that he also exhibited certain forms of aberrant common sense. He believes, for example, he was in the Second World War saving lives in some way, but in fact, he was in the movie industry making shorts for propaganda purposes. Some of the classic stories were he was the announcer for baseball games, and he had this very vivid imagination of how the game was being played from Morse code, and he would get on a local announcement and announce these programs based on what he thought was happening in New York City or someplace else around the world. There are many other cases of this. And if you look at his relationship with his kids, all of you remember Patty Davis, his daughter, you can see how she acted out in many ways against her father. You can also hear the negativism in Nancy Reagan. Just say no was her litany. Remember that under the Reagan administration, we had the 11th commandment in politics. Thou shalt not say something negative against a Republican, but it's okay to say things negative against others. There are many, many other examples. But that's when I thought, I really have to start looking at this. I have to look at not only children, but I have to look at adults. I then started looking at literature for other persons who might be negative. Carol Burnett wrote a really excellent biography where she talks about her childhood, her parents, what they were like, and she credits her use of humor as a result of the negative experiences that she had as a child. Think of Bill Cosby, someone who many people identify as being a very positive person, but if you think back to if you had kids or if you were in that period of time, you had the Fat Albert character. Fat Albert was a manifestation of the sort of the negative image of fat, of size and whatnot. Of course, one of the things that's very nice and very interesting about the negative people and people who lack common sense, and those they're not necessarily one and the same, is that humor is one of the defense mechanisms that they use in order to defend against the negative forces in their lives. So a set of experiences in 1985, 86, and 87 led to some observations not only about the seven original kids, but a group of other kids. And I probably have enough copies of the original outline of a book that I had started in 1987, which I identify many of the characters. It includes Margaret Thatcher, Menachem Begin, many of the stars of Russia. It includes one of the very favorite children's book authors, Roald Dahl. I don't know if you remember Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, something Giant Peach or something like that. But when you read his book, I think it's called Boy, or it's a story of how his family came from Norway originally, moved to England, and how he became this little spiteful terror, and I'm deliberately using that term, of a child. In part because of some experiences, negative experiences he had in his childhood. And so if you look through the Roald Dahl books, although they're very clever, very witty, and children like them, you see repeated instances of negatives that are there. I didn't really do very well. I did one other thing. I gave a talk at a political science convention in Anaheim around that same time, and I asked the question, if you have negative leaders or people who can transmit what I call these psychoviruses, what happens if that person sneezes in, let's say, a small environment like here, where we have 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 13, maybe 15 people? You run the risk of 15 people being infected, but what happens if you sneeze across the nation? Would you not possibly have a larger number of persons to become infected? So what the first thing that I realized one had to do is to introduce epidemiological technologies rather than simply sociological or anthropological or psychological models in order to understand that. And I'll digress for a moment and ask you to think about the World Trade Center situation September 11th. What do you think it's like being at ground zero or near ground zero in lower Manhattan as contrast to being up in Harlem or here in San Francisco? Can you not see that the experiences that people had in New York City are very, very different from what we might be experiencing here on the West Coast? Cars in New York City all have flags on them. Cars out here in fairly low proportion have flags on them. Now think about, for those of you who were around this area in 1989, the situation where the Loma Prieta earthquake occurred in the San Francisco area, where minutes after 5 o'clock, where the World Series was about to begin in the Candlestick Park. And I can remember vividly every second of what was happening as I was driving my car into the garage, and the car started shaking, and I thought, well, my car is dying. And then I noticed the boxes in the garage were moving, and my infant said, something is bigger happening than my car is dying. And that has great poignancy for me. Yet the people on the East Coast, they were concerned about, well, are you close to the fire? Were you on the bridge that was collapsing? What about the part of the freeway in Oakland that collapsed? And of course, we all thought that millions of people were killed, but in fact, it was only a few hundred, as I recall. Maybe not even that. I don't remember the 67, okay. I don't remember the number, but what is striking is that we find that the number of deaths in the World Trade Center is also smaller than we tended to think. We were talking about 30,000 people that morning, and then it was narrowed down to 7,000, and now it's in the low 2,000s. So with that digression, I have, of course, put these aside, but I did introduce the notion of what I call national caveats emptor. A caveat emptor is essentially a statement of let the buyer beware. And I asked the question, we pride ourselves on being a democracy, but I ask you to think, what does it mean to be a democracy? Is it simply voting for a person or making a decision to vote, or does it or should it not involve thinking through something more about the psychological profile of the people that we are voting for? And why this is particularly interesting, in my analysis, and I want to emphasize that this is my analysis, it may not be yours, and I want to also emphasize the talk I'm giving today is purely a scientific talk, not a talk about my politics versus your politics or anyone else's politics. But the thing that is so striking to me is that George W. Bush is probably one of the most negative leaders in the history of recent mankind. Remember, he came into office in December, well, in January of 2001. He was going to change the Missile Defense Treaty. He was going to change the Kyoto Protocol. He was going to change the rules on the way we deal with the forests and forestry. He's going to change the drilling in the in Alaska. He was going to give us an attorney general that was negative. He encountered the situation with the Chinese with the military plane being downed. These were just a small part of of the negativisms associated with his administration. Now, some of you might say, that's a great foreign policy, or that's a great political policy. Remember, he went his first trip abroad, apart from going to Mexico, was to Spain, not to the United Kingdom, or not to Canada, or not to the places that that other U.S. presidents have gone. That's not to say that he was doing anything wrong. It is to say that we need to stop and think about what is it about his administration was negative. And what I will be asking today is, there are many possibilities. There are many, many possibilities. But could it not be that the events of September 11th were, in fact, a provocation, provoked by the George W. Bush administration? Remember that it was also 1 or 2 days just after the U.S. withdrew from the International Congress on Racism, Xenophobia, and Intolerance in Durban, South Africa. Now, again, I don't want you to think that I'm taking a particular strong view. And in fact, it's for those of you who are looking at some of the other negative events in the world, Ariel Sharon is another example of someone who has been extraordinarily negative. Some would say his trip up to the Temple Mount, where he took a 1,000-man police force, and I don't remember the exact number, but that was the provocation that led to the second intifada that we have. And now we have huge numbers of Palestinian and Israeli lives that have been lost because of his policies. And you could predict that, in fact, if you followed his career in the past. It goes back to his military stint when he was Minister of Defense under, I forget whose administration, it was Begin of, I don't remember whose. So I began asking the question, and I want you to think of it in this way. Let's suppose you have cancer. The immediate cause of death may not be the cancer itself. It may be pneumonia. It may be something else. Or let's suppose you have HIV. The immediate cause of death may not be AIDS per se, it may be some infection of some final sort. So it is clear, I don't think anyone would question, anyone would doubt that there are these what we would call terrorist cells that are in the United States. The question is, was there some final provocation that sort of pushed us over the top? Now, what I want you to think about, and this is the sort of the gist of the talk, and then I'll come back and put it in a broader perspective. What I want you to think about is two people in this situation, actually three or four, I say three or four, because as an African-American, I'm worried about what will be the long-term implications of the Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell administration. Might not this tar African Americans in the long run as being people who were the source of this foreign policy when in fact it is George Bush? So we have to look at it as a really big shell game rather than a sort of a local shell game. But what I want you to think about is, what do you know about George W. Bush, and what do you know about Osama bin Laden, assuming Osama bin Laden is one of the major sources behind this conflict? I think that we could take that as a given, but I do think we need to allow justice to go its course before we make any final conclusions. But the point I want to make first, though, is, before some of you came in, George was showing a CNN interview between Lamb and Peter Bergen, which was recently telecast, where Bergen was talking about some of the things he's learned about Osama bin Laden, his experiences as a child, his father being killed in an aircraft accident, his being the only son of the Syrian mother of a set of other mothers or other wives that Osama's father had. How the things that he did were logical to him, even though we may not perceive it as logical to us. And I would point out, for example, that many persons in our society are making a big deal about the number of civilians that were killed. But if you think about it, what is really extraordinary is that he attacked symbols of Western society, the World Trade Center, the Pentagon. And I have no doubt that he was headed for either the White House or Congress or one of the other institutions in Washington. He did the same thing when there were the two embassies, one in, is it Kenya, or I forget where the Kenya and Tanzania or some place. I don't remember where the two places were, but they were in within 9 minutes of each other around the world. So here we have a person who is exquisite in his use of his sense of logic to show that he has outwitted the most incredible intelligence machine in the world. And for those of you old enough to remember the Sputnik, and ask the question, I ask you the question, do you recall what the effect of the Sputnik was when it beamed across the United States? The Soviets were really clever, for those of you who are interested in technology. They had the signals geared to American shortwave so that the kids could hear these things going across the country. And we were all in awe of this. And in fact, if you stop and think about it, that is what's given us the telecommunications that we now have. I remember in 1957 how almost overnight, we had major changes in our science textbooks and mathematics and whatnot. And so I ask you now to think about what could possibly be some of the changes that will come about as a result of the Osama bin Laden or whomever, this terrorist act. At the very least, we should see new forms of mathematics that deal with simultaneous equations, that deal with finance, that deal with economics, that deal with codes, breaking codes, that deal with political issues, that deal with religious issues. Americans are not typically trained to see that extent of the big picture. Will we not see a shift in some of these things? So, among other things, I'm not glorifying terrorism, but I'm asking you to ask yourselves what could possibly be some of the consequences that will come out of this set of events that we have. Let me launch now into where I'm going with this. I'm going to try to run about an hour and a half, and then I'll take questions until 5 or 6 or 7 o'clock. I'm here for the duration. I'm willing to spend all day, all night with you to talk about things. But I'm going to announce fundamental breaking new ground in the way we conceptualize the mind as a result of what has happened in September, and in my personal life, what has happened in October 9th through the 14th. And let me just say something about the 9th through the 14th. I decided to go to Stockholm this year to see the announcements of the Nobel Prizes this year. And the reason I decided to do it, number one, this is the 100th anniversary of the Nobel Prize, and I wanted to find out whether there would be any unusual pomp and circumstance. And secondly, there was a conference going on single nucleotide polymorphisms. Now, I didn't quite understand single nucleotide polymorphisms, but it was by being in Stockholm at that particular time and having the back of my mind that I wanted to pursue an experiment that is related to the paper I wrote in 1979, where I talked about when people learn in long-term memory their changes in DNA. This is an extremely provocative notion because most people think that the DNA in every cell is the same throughout the body. That is given to us from Charles Darwin's notion on evolution or evolution. Lamarck, on the other hand, argued that neither of them knew about DNA. Keep that in mind. DNA was not even known at that time. But as a result of Lamarck's notion, people rejected the Lamarckian hypothesis that one's experiences get transmitted to the offspring. And where, if we think about it, is the disjunction is that there is no connection between brain or the immune system and the germline, the ovaries, the testes, and whatnot. So if there are changes in DNA, I'm saying that those changes are local. They are in structures that have memory potential. And the reason I started focusing on the Solvaruses back in 1977 through 79 is because they contain clues, I believe, to how that DNA is changing. Now, coming back to the kids that I talked about here, I asked the question, could it be that as we develop over time, from birth to death, using perhaps a notion of Piaget, but it doesn't have to be a Piaget, the changes are taking place in the forebrain, in the section of the brain up here, which we typically associate with cognition. I'm asking a second question, what about emotions? We typically think that they're associated with the amygdala. It could be other possibilities, but could it be that the amygdala is seeing a second set of changes that are not the changes that we typically would have in forebrain? Now, why this is important in the context of the discussion I introduced about common sense, we very often hear the statement, this kid is brilliant, but has no common sense. Have you ever heard that expression? I'm going to give you an example of this momentarily from one of my original patients. And so I had to struggle with the question, how could a person be logically brilliant but have no common sense otherwise? Could the common sense be associated with emotions or morality or sensory motor situations or something else? So I'm going to postulate that there's DNA changing in brain. I'm going to postulate that there may be DNA changing in regions associated with emotions, which I'm focusing on the amygdala right now, but it could be other structures. I'm asking the question, what about the cerebellum? We know that the cerebellum is involved in sensory motor behavior. We know that when you get up and you learn to crawl and you learn to walk and you learn to have hand and eye coordination and things of that sort, those changes take place in the cerebellum. Are the same changes that are occurring in the cerebellum those that might happen in the amygdala and the forebrain? And so be it. In fact, we have Jacobs and others talk about self-identity. So I decided, as a result of the conference I went to in Stockholm, that I now can see how to make the big leap that I will announce today, a set of experiments that are about to begin shortly. We have some of the material identified, we have some of the researchers identified, and it promises to be one of the most exciting developments, I believe, ever that will be the case. And then I'll come back and relate this to Osama bin Laden, to George Bush, and to others. It's a good question. I didn't include something here because I don't know enough about the brain at this stage in time about what's going on there. But once the experiments are complete, I will tell you how to go back and ask the question, in what structures might those things take place? So it's a really excellent question, but you have to understand that we cannot know everything at the outset. And what I'm seeking to do is to go in a systematic, step-by-step way to help us make fundamental breakthroughs, and then I will tell you how to come back and answer some of these questions. The experiment that is going to be done, that is now in progress, is to take 9 individuals or postmortem material from 9 individuals, a person who would be 2 to 3 years old, a person who would be 20 years old, a person who would be 40 years old, a person who would be 60 years old, Einstein, Albert Einstein's brain, and 2 sets of identical twins. One set of identical twins where they were raised together, the other set of identical twins where they were raised apart. What I would predict is that the changes associated with the forebrain are going to be slow and consistent over time, almost constant. I would predict that there are going to be changes from guanine and cytosine, I'm sorry, from adenosine and thymidine, the AT-rich regions of brain, to GC-rich regions, the guanine and cytosine, for a variety of reasons. One, because adenosine is known to autoregulate dreaming, And I believe the dreams are, in fact, the portal to long-term memory formation. I believe that the T-base pair, it has three connections, is a much more avidly bonded connection. And that subsequent to these changes in DNA, we will see the formation of dendrite and axon connectivity. So this is an a posteriori event rather than a priori event. We change the DNA, and then you see an outgrowth of axon and dendritic connections. So the neural network that we hear people talk about is subsequent to DNA change, at least in my theory, and that's what I hope to prove. Now, let me step back a moment and say something about another development that took place earlier this year. We had in February announcements from two research teams, one headed by Francis Collins for the government, and the other headed by Craig Venter from Solera, where they claimed to have sequenced the DNA in the human genome. And the thing that was interesting about their findings were that roughly 1.2% of all the DNA in the human genome accounts for proteins that would be encoded. Roughly 22-point-something% of the DNA would account for regulatory elements. So more than 75% of the DNA is unaccounted for. And I'm suggesting that some of that encodes evolutionary memory, some of it encodes speciation, some of it encodes developmental memory, and of course some of it encodes cognition, immunity, and aging. Now, there's something else I want you to think about, and I want you to think about this in a teleological way rather than a chemical or another way. Imagine being God, if you were God. Would you waste your time with a structure up here that has a bunch of redundant information that you would not know how to make sense of it? Why would you create a set of millions and millions of different proteins in the brain if you're not going to use them? You really don't need to have billions of new proteins every time you learn something. It just doesn't make sense. Likewise, it doesn't make sense to have a new cell being created every time something is learned. You might want more connections, but you don't want multiple copies of cells, because then you have to keep track of these proteins and keep track of the cells. And that's just not the way efficiency works. And it certainly, in my view, is not the way God works. So my thesis is that the bony cranium, if you thump your head, you feel it, the bony cranium served for evolutionary purposes to constrain the development of cell division, but not changes in DNA. And likewise, and this is why it's going to be so exciting for orthomolecular psychiatry, and what it's consistent with what we see in the real world, we do not see massive new proteins being generated in the brain. I mean, you can take samples of the brain, you just don't see new proteins being generated. So what I suggest is that we're going to find that for this 75, or let's say even 25% of the 75%, a fourth of it, you're going to find that there may be axonal and dendritic connections, but you're not going to find unique proteins being generated. So what in the long run, which comes back to your original question, what in the long run we're going to need to do, once I have demonstrated that the changes are taking place, then we can find the technologies to go back and to show, given we start teaching moral issues, we put a NMR device on us, and we can see how the changes are taking place systematically and systemically. At this point, we have to demonstrate the change first, and then we can come back later and ask, well, what happens if you're blind? Here's a good example. If you're born blind, you're going to have a certain set of cerebellar events that one learns to use to compensate for that blindness. But if one is blind after birth, suppose it's like Ray Charles or Stevie Wonder, These people were not born blind. So they started out with one form of cerebellar development, and then subsequently they've had to adjust. So we're going to see a different pattern of DNA changes associated with blindness, or with moral issues, or with identity issues, or with other kinds of things. And that's what I think is going to be, that's where I think there's going to be a great deal of excitement to come along in the future. Now, I want to point out one other implication that you may not be able to see at the moment, but if you reflect on it for a night or two, you're going to see that it's probably the most exciting set of possibilities that we can now conjure. Remember that we often talk about nature and we talk about nurture. Do any of you remember hearing these terms and the philosophical issues that take place in your philosophy classes and whatnot? I'm saying to you for the first time that we now will have an ability to distinguish between, at the molecular level and at the mathematical level, nature versus nurture. I'm saying to you that things like skin and color and proteins associated with fingernails and eye color and hair texture and all these different things, those are components of nature. And in fact, in the literature right now that's emerging, this is called the proteome. We often use the symbol P to reflect this section of the human genome that encodes the proteins. But the genome, as I said, the proteome is only 25% of this human genome. So there's 75% of this G, where G minus P would represent, in effect, nurture. And I said to you, I anticipate that we're going to see AT-rich regions being converted to GC-rich regions. So I expect that we're going to be able to get a crude measure of nurture by looking at how these changes in the ratio of AT-rich to GC-rich regions change. So somewhere in the future, we will, I believe, be able to not just wave our hands dealing with this notion of nurture. We'll actually be able to say this nurturance took place in this way, in this context, for this particular person. Now let's go back to what I started talking about. I started telling you about a group of kids who had no common sense, if you recall. Well, one of the kids that I dealt with, or persons at that point, was one of my office assistants. I won't give her name. She's now 40-something years old, and she has a 9-year-old son. Her 9-year-old son has never been in a men's room alone. In other words, I happened to find this out because I was driving them from Albany to her mother's home in West Hollywood, and we stopped at a rest stop to get a dinner, and I was just flummoxed, surprised that she said, "Oh, he cannot go in the men's room. He has to come in the women's room with me." Now, just imagine, for those of you who are women, going into a room with a young boy 9 years old with a mother. Do you not see this as being somewhat abnormal? I was surprised. I said, "Let me take the child into the men's room." And in fact, what I did, I